this came from an experience with a patient. It was early in my analytic training, and I was working with a supervisor who I really admired and worked with her for a number of years. She was very Kleinian, post-Kleinian, and was great at interpretation formulation. And she was really helpful with just starting to like guide me towards a lot of this work. And I remember describing to her what felt like I was describing a patient session, and I was going through my process notes, and I said, I feel like the patient is inside of me. I feel like they're like, they want something that's in me, and I don't know what it is. And I can't quite access my own self. Like, I don't know what to do. And it was through this initial, you know, experience where I was just, because I really felt it, like, and, you know, obviously then again, back to why analytic training versus other, you know, maybe less intense trainings. It was, we were also, right, I think at the time doing like infant development. So it was early in my training. And, you know, she described it as like, well, think of what, you know, an infant or even a toddler, when they want, you know, their parent, you know, originally, right, the mother, they want something from the mother, and the mother kind of feels this kind of gripping or this yearning of the baby wanting something. And I started to think of my patients, not as infants or babies, but that what I was feeling was that there was something that the person I was working with needed, and they didn't have words yet to tell me what that was.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Pamela Puglisi. Pamela Puglisi is an advanced candidate in psychoanalysis at the Contemporary Freudian Society in New York City. Our conversation today focuses on two areas. A, what is it like to be a candidate in psychoanalysis in the year 2026? What brings one to this work? The personal interests, the professional interests. And we also discuss the kinds of patients that most fascinate her and with whom she has a great deal of experience. And those are the patients who have been variously categorized famously by Betty Joseph as those, quote, who were difficult to reach, and more contemporaneously as patients who have difficulty in symbolization. And we consider what are the characteristics of these patients and what are the clinical challenges, especially as it relates to the countertransference experience. Pamela earned her Master's of Social Work in Advanced Standing Clinical Practice from Fordham University at Lincoln Center. And as I mentioned, she's an advanced candidate at the Contemporary Freudian Society. She also completed a two-year Advanced Psychodynamic Psychotherapy Certificate in the Integrated Treatment of Eating Disorders from the Institute of Contemporary Psychotherapy and the Center for Study of Anorexia and Bulimia. And she also completed a Contemporary Freudian Society's two-year psychoanalytic psychotherapy program. What this evidence is one of the things that becomes clear in our conversation. She is a woman of intense curiosity, a deep interest to know thoroughly and thoughtfully and to bring that to her work with her patients. I hope you feel as I do that with Pamela and people with such interests, our field in the future is assured of a vibrancy that we can be proud of. Here's my conversation with Pamela Polizzi. Pam, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
Pam, psychoanalytic candidates, as you well know, are the future of our field, which makes it all the more important for our community to provide a public forum to get to know psychoanalytic candidates, to get familiar with their unique journeys. Everybody has a journey how they become a psychoanalyst, and they have things in common and, of course, many things that are unique. And it's important that we as a community get familiar with both the common themes that lead people to enter this field and also the unique moments that bring them to this work. And it's also important for us to get a sense of what kind of patients they may be interested in working with. Many people don't have preferences, but many do. And you've made clear, as we will discuss, that you do have particular interests. And I've borrowed for the title of this podcast, the title of Betty Joseph's 1975 classic paper, The Patient Who is Difficult to Reach, who you too have referenced as an important benchmark for your own thinking. And we will get to your thinking about these patients and a fictionalized version of a patient to discuss it in real time. But let me begin by turning it over to you to ask you to share your journey, how you got to this very unique field of study and clinical work.
Thank you, Harvey. It's a pleasure to be here. So I actually, as you were introducing me, I was thinking something my own analyst will say to me is like, nobody gets into this line of work for no reason or by accident. And I think in my case, that's probably true in terms of the work, you know, the type of patient I see right now. I think that was kind of like an unconscious accident, which I will get into later. But in high school, I struggled with like my own anxieties. I was in a competitive athletic sport that was very body focused and weight focused. And through that, my anxieties came out through my body and weight. And so I kind of pivoted, you know, after getting mental health treatment myself, to from like going into thinking that I was going to do more of a creative field in fashion to actually wanting to pursue a degree in social work to become a psychotherapist. From there, you know, I checked all the boxes. I went to undergrad, then graduate school, got my MSW, and realized like I kind of felt like I was checking the boxes, but I didn't know exactly what I was doing, which I feel is kind of a parallel to probably the process of being an analyst overall. You kind of never know what you're doing in some ways, which makes it kind of exciting too. But what was happening was when I graduated and I started working in the field, I did a lot of my internships were in like psychiatric hospitals in New York. And then I also worked at outpatient clinic work with substance abuse users. And I was coming into contact with a lot of very diverse populations, but also very diverse and very complicated issues that these patients were going through. And I really felt like I was unprepared. I also still really wanted to work in the eating disorder field. And everyone kind of kept telling me, well, you know, there was at the time in Manhattan, there was probably like two eating disorder facilities that, you know, you could work at. And everyone's like, you need experience. I'm like, well, how am I supposed to get experience if I, you know, if you won't hire me? So I actually, that was what prompted me to go into my first psychodynamic institute training. And through that training, it was psychodynamic base, but it was for eating disorders. And that was at the Institute of Contemporary Psychotherapy in Manhattan. And it was through that two-year program that I realized like, oh, I really wish I had done more psychoanalytic background, because it's really only a couple of classes, if that, in graduate school. And I realized that I really didn't have the kind of foundation I wanted, but the curiosity that it left me with and the idea that I could go deeper with this type of patient, which really, if anyone knows anything about eating disorder work and the population, a lot of it is very behavioral. And a lot of times you do have to have behavioral points of reference to work with if someone's very symptomatic, but there's so much underneath that. So from there, I completed that training, started my private practice in Manhattan, and then went on to really wanting to do like an actual analytic training, but decided I'd do a 2-year, like just psychoanalytic, psychodynamic institute training through the Contemporary Freudian Society, just to make sure that I definitely wanted to do it, because it is a very long investment, time, money, energy, and I just wanted to really make sure that I was completely ready for it. And through that training, I really found that, you know, it was kind of this interesting parallel again, where I was at a point where I was working with like a newer analyst at the time. This was almost like 10 years ago, and kind of doing a lot of my own work. And I also found that the patients I was working with, as they were starting to kind of start to like lessen their use of their own eating disorder behaviors, other stuff was coming up. It was like we all had, like, I was having things come up personally. My patients were having things come up that I didn't really know how to work with. And then I was in this training, also in my own treatment. And I realized like there is so much more here that I don't know. And really, the not knowing for me is this challenge that I really enjoy. I kind of think like, okay, if I don't know something, I want to figure it out. And if I don't know something, I've also learned to kind of sit with the uncertainty of that. So, you know, I completed that 2-year training, and then I waited about a year or so, and then I began the analytic training at CFS in Manhattan to become an analyst. And it was during COVID, at the beginning of COVID. It's a very intense training at CFS. It's a really great community there. And through that, I really realized that you can work with not just eating disorders, but you can work with the parts underneath a person's eating disorder in an analytic way. And that's why I'm here today, because I really believe that there is a nature to this work that's much more accessible than sometimes people realize.
Let me ask you about your analytic training. You say CFS, it's the Contemporary Freudian Society, in the one in Manhattan. And you really have a unique perspective, because you've done both psychotherapy training, dynamic psychotherapy training, and the analytic training. Are there important similarities and differences that you could share?
I think it's almost like the same way I would describe undergrad to graduate school to training. It's like, it's a foundation. It's a foundation that helped me realize, for me at least, that I wanted more in-depth training. I think psychoanalytic work, in terms of, you know, at CFS, we do, it's like 4 years of study, and there's three trimesters. So, and you do 2 classes each trimester. So you're talking about 6 classes for 4 years. That's 24 classes. That's a lot different than 8 classes over 2 years. So it is it's a much more in-depth training. We also, you know, at CFS, you have a supervisor, you could have 1 to 2, you could really have as many supervisors as you like, depending on how, you know, how many cases you have and how, you know, diverse you want to kind of learn, like the diversity of like the populations you're like curious to work with in terms of the supervision that you seek. You also have to be in your own analysis 3 to 4 times a week or more. So it's different in the sense of you're really kind of living, breathing everything, yes. Analysis. Yeah. And it makes sense. You know, it does. And I think it was probably around like year 2 or 3 of my of my coursework where I realized, like, I started to understand the puzzle. Like, okay, because like there was something else that I'm not sure exactly where I heard it, but it was like you can only really go as far or take a patient as far as you've gone. And in this work, the process is one that is really unknown for your own self and for your patients, and to be able to withstand it for yourself, like that uncertainty of being in a process of learning and growing for yourself is one that you almost have to really be able to kind of walk through on your own before you can really walk a patient through that or, you know, another individual through that.
I just want to agree with and underline what you're pointing out, that the immersive experience of being in your own intensive treatment and working with other individuals in an intensive treatment of theirs, all the while having that work supervised by somebody who is intimately familiar with that intensive treatment, it is a remarkable experience. And, you know, there's a danger of it taking on sort of religious tones when one says, if you haven't done it, you don't know what it is. And, you know, there's a downside to that. But the truth of the matter is, if you haven't done it, you don't know what it is. It really gives you access to parts of the human experience that otherwise isn't available. And when you see folks who are working on a more surface with patients, not out of choice, but that's the only thing they know to do, you sort of left, well, what do I say to the person? Because I've had the experience, A, personally, but also with other individuals that have given us access to more poignant, more personal, more irrational, more foundational, more childlike aspects of who they are. And that has been able to liberate them to live a fuller life. And you want to tell people about it, which I guess is what we're doing. That very thing today. So with that.
To your point about this idea that this, like you can't know it until you're in it. I think it took about 5 years actually for me to like, you know, that's why I did the 2-year program first to kind of get, I wanted to make sure it was the right institute for me too. I had actually gone to open houses at other institutes. There's actually quite a few institutes in Manhattan, you know, which is not certainly the case in a lot of other areas or even in, you know, in the United States. And I will say that because of that, I did actually go to a number of open houses. And the way that it can be approached in terms of like, I guess the selling point, let's call it for I guess lack of a better term, can come off a little bit indoctrination sure. kind of quality to it that is a little bit unless you're in it. But I, you know, I didn't feel that way at the institute that I'm in. And I felt like, I think, you know, it was more of a feeling that it's a personal experience that you're going to have. However you use it is how you're going to use it. And it wasn't as much about, you know, professional growth as it was personal growth, which I found to be much more refreshing than some of the ways that
sounds
even
like you found a very good match. Can kind
of like definitely, yeah,
yeah, yeah. Let's talk about your conceptual perspective on these patients, the ones we're sort of quickly calling the ones difficult to reach, and we'll talk about what that means. What interests you in them? What has drawn you to them? How you've come to understand? And then we'll come up with an example. It is, to reemphasize, a fictional example. There aren't confidences being shared, but it's a type of patient that you've had experience working with, and we can talk a bit about that.
Sure. So, like I said earlier, I didn't get into this field by accident, but I do believe I came upon this type of patient by kind of an unconscious accident, in the sense that I really didn't understand early on in my career that, I knew that there were other things that, you know, a person doesn't just choose an eating disorder. And there are things that drive a person to develop, right, an eating disorder. Those are just the symptoms that someone's presenting with, just like substance abuse or any other kind of addiction. Or even if we think about, you know, really the depths of maybe even psychosis, right? Like, we're really looking at the developmental piece and attachment and early life, right? So there's something about, again, when you kind of, just going back to what you said about, you know, how does this differ, analytic training versus like a 2-year psychodynamic program? It's, you really get to kind of understand the different levels of the structure of a person's mind. In theory, obviously, right? In the theoretical approaches that we learn. And you start to really be able to think in so much more nuanced ways to help a patient think in more nuanced ways about their own life and about how they got to where they are and why they do what they do. And what I had found prior to starting more analytic work and more analytic, even like supervision, which I actually did some more intense supervision prior to my analytic training, just to, again, really wanted to like ensure that this is what I wanted to do, is that I found that a lot of the patients I was working with, I mean, my whole practice was eating disorder focused. So all my patients that I worked with had some type of issue with food and their body. And after they were either not symptomatic or there was other things going on, I found that I didn't quite know what to do. And I found myself feeling very stuck and frustrated. I also found that they were feeling quite stuck and frustrated. There was this like emotional, almost unrest in them. And also a lot of dysregulation that at that time, you know, we're talking probably 8 or so years ago, that I wasn't as attuned to, you know, the factors of transference and countertransference and how that was getting, you know, played out in the treatment. And I was definitely, I was containing, but I wasn't contained. And I wasn't able to really understand what to do with that emotional content. And I think this work has really kind of shaped, I think, right, like whether they talk about it as like an analytic attitude or reverie, is like, is the idea that we can hold and bear what is unbearable to the patient. And that is the type of patient that I've, again, unconsciously, you know, started to work with. And I really enjoy working with patients who really, on the surface, I mean, have so much of their life together. They're, you know, professionals, and they're smart, and they're capable, and they are funny, and they have these great lives, but they don't know how to live them. They really struggle to be in the world. And it's kind of, it's hard to bear as the therapist or the analyst to be, because you can really feel the pain in that. And I think that piece, when I started to realize that part, made me more apt to look further for like more resources of how to treat patients like this.
One of the ways you characterize it, you sent me in our email exchange a number of phrases that represent what you've come to learn and appreciate in your work. And picking up on what you're saying, you spoke about being in a process of uncertainty with a patient, that is, tolerating that uncertainty, not as an end, I presume, but as a place to let the moment mature in you so that some understanding can come from it. You also have a phrase that really drew me. You write, how to do less when the patient wants more of and from you. How to do less when the patient wants more of and from you. That's a tense, on the one hand, of course, it has a Zen wisdom quality to it. But on the other hand, in practice, it's not such an easy thing either for you or the patient. The patient is wanting, as you write, wanting more of and from you. And in the face of that, you recommend doing less. So tell us a bit about how that idea comes to you and how it lives in your work?
Sure. Yeah. I will say this. This came from an experience with a patient. It was early in my analytic training. I was working with a supervisor who I really admired and worked with her for a number of years. She was very Kleinian, post-Kleinian, and was great at interpretation formulation. And she was really helpful with just starting to guide me towards a lot of this work. And I remember describing to her what felt like I was describing a patient session, and I was going through my process notes, and I said, I feel like the patient is inside of me. I feel like they want something that's in me, and I don't know what it is. I can't quite access my own self. I don't know what to do. And it was through this initial, experience where I was just crap, because I could really, I really felt it. Obviously then again, back to why analytic, training versus other, maybe less intense trainings. We were also, right, I think at the time doing infant development. So it was early in my training. And, she described it as think of what, an infant or even a toddler, when they want, their parent, originally, right, the mother, they want something from the mother, and the mother kind of feels this kind of gripping or this yearning of the baby wanting something. And I started to think of my patients, not as infants or babies, but that what I was feeling was that there was something that the person I was working with needed, and they didn't have words yet to tell me what that was. And that was really helpful, because in the moment I really did feel I feel helpless. But that also helped me realize that is how the person sitting across from me was feeling, helpless,
And that was the best way they knew how to communicate it without words, but by projecting something inside you. How did that encounter evolve? Was the patient able to find words, or were you able to find words, or how did it ripen?
So with this specific patient, again, this was a while back, but it was probably the first few sessions. It was someone new who had come to my, had been referred to me. And I actually thought, I brought it to my supervisor at that time. I was like, I don't know if I can work with this patient. And what had happened was what I was feeling actually made me actually kind of freeze in the session. And not in a way of not being able to think, but I found myself pulling back, because the patient was almost forcing something into me and so it almost made me start to actually, it's kind of hard to explain, but it almost made me need to do the opposite of what I was experiencing.
Sure.
Having that experience actually showed me okay, there's something kind of really coming at me here, and I don't know what it is. And instead of pretending I do, pretty much, I just have to sit here and take it and kind of sit here and just understand that I'm not going to understand what's happening. And when I looked back, there was a couple of other instances where this had happened. And I think at the time, what I thought about was, or how I interpreted myself, what I was kind of experiencing, was that there was something that the person sitting across from me was showing me also about not only what they needed or wanted from me, but also how they interact interpersonally, that I needed to be aware of for if we were going to continue working together. Meaning, they probably don't know what to do with a connection, or how to have boundaries, or how to take in another person as another separate person. And also that there was something that felt very, there was a fragility to it, but there was also something that felt hypervigilant in it, that made me all, it left me with a lot of questions. And I would just like kind of bookmark them in my mind, like, okay, save this for later, listen to something, listen out for this for later. And that's kind of how I started to organize it myself. Because I think in these moments, sometimes when we, as therapists or analysts to be, find ourselves unable to think or feel or know, is this mine? Is this theirs? Is this what's coming up here? I start to think like, I'm just going to like bookmark it. I'm just going to like post it this for later and I can come back to it at some point. Like there will be an entry point at some other time. And it started to help me learn that I could sit through it. So to your question, I realized that actually I could sit through this person's very, very hyper-vigilant states and overwhelm and survive it. And I've been working with that person since then. So I guess something's working.
It reminds me of a quote that you noted also from Betty Joseph. She writes, "What it means to stay alive in the treatment of patients who are addicted to punishing themselves." That's really what you're referring to, not just staying alive, but staying clinically functional, which is tolerating the uncertainty and tolerating their hypervigilance and it matching your own hypervigilance that can get stirred up and putting it in service of the work.
The case that I'm going to present today is a case of a patient I've been working with for a few years now, about over 4 years. She's a 35-year-old single female Latina. I'm going to call her G. And she came to me by way of a referral through a colleague at the time. The patient G was struggling with an eating disorder. And within the first like session or two, I found kind of similar to what I was saying is that I was very consumed by not necessarily the reaching in or feeling like that this patient G wanted something from me, but actually the opposite, that she didn't want anything from me. And that was quite confusing at the time. Because I couldn't really understand why G was coming to our sessions or why she was even really seeking treatment at the time. She wasn't even very explicit about or really expressive about what was actually going on in terms of symptoms. And anytime I was, you know, in the first session or two, I probably work maybe a little less analytically, especially with eating disorder patients, because I do need to get, you know, assess like really kind of symptomology to some extent. I also like to know, you know, I also like to know like background treatment history. That also helps, I think, just understand like, okay, what is someone's, you know, viability to connection and continuing a relationship at this level. And I was getting very like evasiveness, almost to the point where like I was becoming very disorganized with the information. Like everything was in these broad generalizations or these idioms or like kind of one-off like examples but they weren't personalized. It was, I really, in the moment, thinking back, I didn't know what I was, you know, I didn't know what I was sitting in front of. But I also was hit. What I was hit with, what I can remember, is severe hostility, rage, and as if instead of wanting something from me, almost as if I was doing something to them, to G. Like it felt like I was hurting her or punishing her or like I was holding her hostage here. It was, and what actually came out for me was this feeling of like, I want to reject this patient. Like, I don't want to work with this patient. I don't want this. I'm still working with this patient. But it was this interesting way of using my own countertransference to really hone in on what was actually going on here. What was the patient unconsciously projecting into me that they couldn't put into words, that they unconsciously had no idea they were even doing, were feeling. And what came to be in terms of G's history was that, you know, this is someone whose parents were both pretty heavy substance abusers and had mental health issues. The patient was the youngest of two, and because of the patient's parents, you know, very, very intense mental health issues and substance use issues, the patient's reality was kind of distorted and denied, in the sense of any reality to, like, actually, like, the parents getting any help ever. And it was also, you know, seen as kind of just like, this is what we do. Like, the parents just, you know, use drugs or drinking, and that was what they did. And so it became a part of this patient's life.
Let me ask you about your description.
Sure.
When you say, it's really powerful, you say, instead of wanting something from me, she perceived that you were hurting her. Now, that's a rich description. On the one hand, whether she was actually hurt, physically abused, which would orient one, speaking about hypervigilance, to being attuned not to one's inner experience, but to the dangers around her, and first and foremost that, but also the case that there are certain individuals who, at least initially in treatment, who have this experience where if they are feeling something dysphoric, it is because you are doing something to them. That dysphoria, by definition, is in relation to a perceived external badness. That there isn't an internal dysphoria that originates from the inside, which presents obviously challenges in working in an uncovering or a dynamic exploratory treatment, because one will get to painful places, at which point these patients, by virtue of either their history of abuse or their internal need to not feel themselves, they will then see you, if not convince you, that you are hurting them. And that's one of the challenges of our field.
I think you said it quite well. It is the convincing me I'm hurting her that I often feel. And this is something, you know, even continuously, you know, currently and on a pretty continuous basis, that, like, feeling as if I'm holding this patient hostage, feeling like I'm doing something to her. And what happened very early on was I found myself so confused, one, because she also came off very, very suspicious to me, like, towards me and to me. Like, so I felt that she was, like, suspicious in how she was evasive in her answering of my questions or responses to even observations I would make or reflections I would make back to her. Or she would always tell me I was wrong. If I tried to reflect something back, I heard it wrong. So again, like, this convincing me that I was, like, doing something, like, bad, which had this other kind of freezing effect for me, because it's like nothing I could produce was good. So everything, like, it was like the bad breast or the bad milk. Like, I was, like, everything was being regurgitated or, like, spit back up towards me. Like, she was spitting up everything I was giving her, pretty much. But also the level of suspicion started to actually become interesting in the early treatment, where I realized I was actually working with someone who, you know, back to, like, the difficult to reach, there's also the idea of, like, difficult to reach because it's difficult to stay with this type of patient. And, you know, I think Betty Joseph talks about this to some extent, you know, that some of these patients also have other mechanisms of their personality structure that, you know, that they're trying to keep together, you know, as tightly as possible, because they're afraid that if they don't keep it together, and I think this is where an eating disorder really comes into place as, like, the glue, is that if that part breaks, this other part will come out. And for this patient, G, you know, this was probably one of the first times in a more kind of clinically, maybe, like, a clinical, like, example that I could actually see, like, that this was a patient who really had, like, a psychotic core to them. And I found that I was really working with someone who like needed to keep parts of their eating disorder, like so that they could stay together emotionally and mentally. So that also gave me really a really clear view of like, okay, I need to work really slow with this patient, which is something that I talk about, is that I really try to slow down the work so much with patients like this, because if you go too fast, you could leave them without any defenses. I like to use like metaphors a lot in my work. And Joseph talks about this a lot too, is that, you know, there's this idea that it's almost like a form of communication. And I think for patients like this, it's simple, it's clear. And I like to use metaphors, especially ones that like relate to a specific patient, so that they can really like hold it in mind. And this is a patient who also, you know, needs kind of simple, clear, concise ways of thinking. But something that I think about with patients like this in general is like, I wouldn't want to go outside when it's like below zero with no clothes on. That's what we would do if we try to like strip someone of their defenses. So we have to be really careful about like what is, because we don't know what's underneath. And I think that's the uncertainty and the not knowing part here.
There's another important point that Joseph makes in the difficult to reach paper. She writes, "I find with these rather unreachable patients, it is often more important to focus one's attention on the patient's method of communication, the actual way in which he speaks and the way in which he reacts to the analyst's interpretations, rather than to concentrate primarily on the content of what he says. In other words, I'm going to suggest that we have to recognize that these patients, even when they are quite verbal, are in fact doing a great deal of acting, sometimes in speech itself, and our technique has constantly to take account of this." Now, in 1975, that was a revolutionary idea. I think it is more generally accepted nowadays, but it sounds relevant to the work you're describing as well.
Exactly. I actually noted that same area as like the attention of the method of communication and the way that I think about it with patients. And actually, my current supervisor, before she became an analyst, she was a classical musician, and she talks a lot about like really listening to the patients in sessions and listening to like the music. And from someone who my family, artists and musicians, and I was thinking about like the idea of the drummer, and this is how I think of the patient. And usually the drummer is the person in the band who like keeps the beat. And so you would think the analyst is that, but really with patients like that, I think of them as moment to moment patients. But if you think of them as a drummer, right, we're really thinking that the patient is keeping the rhythm, they're keeping the beat. So we, the analysts or analysts-to-be, we aren't the guides of that rhythm. The patients are, and we are listening to how the patient keeps their own unique rhythm or beat. And we're using that as data to help support and guide them into like integrating these parts of themselves that they're trying, you know, to discover why they're coming to us.
You know, you mentioned musician, and one of the pleasures for me of interviewing colleagues from around the world is to note not only their uniquenesses, but their commonalities. And it was recently that I interviewed Dana Amir from Haifa, who wrote also about the importance of her musicianship in listening to the words. In fact, the way she said it, being a psychoanalyst doesn't mean giving up being a musician, which is sort of your point exactly. You had mentioned the presence of supervision. That's an important piece of all of our development. Couldn't you share some perspectives on how supervisors have assisted you in your journey?
Yeah, and I will also like speak directly to this case of, you know, that this has helped me because, you know, this is a patient that I really enjoy working with them. And sometimes it is hard, right, to listen to the music. It's hard to listen to the rhythm. And so my supervisor uses a lot of these metaphors and the idea of staying alive and surviving. Sometimes the music that, or the rhythms that this patient is playing has been really helpful. I think also, I think about G as like, okay, when her rhythm, when the music she's playing in sessions. And, you know, we could think about it too. Like, it doesn't have to be, when I said like moment to moment, what I mean by this type of patient is that anytime I go into a session, I don't know how G will present. But this is a lot of my patients, or how they will present throughout the session, right? Like, they will shift. So if I think about language as rhythm, right? So instead of them being, you know, G being able to use language and words, I'm, you know, again, like you said, it's not really the content of what they're saying, it's the rhythm of what they're saying. Mm-hmm. And so if I think of that as like, you know, this is a pre-verbal patient.
Just to be clear, it was Betty Joseph who said it, though I agree with
you. Okay. Yes. And so if I think of it as like a pre-verbal, you know, someone who's pre-verbal, like, this is how they are showing me, you know, their language. And so with my supervisor, you know, she's even saying to me, do less, especially when the rhythm, right, becomes more chaotic. Or you can think, I think of it as like the drummer has like, is off beat or has kind of gone off, right? Has lost the rest of the band, mm-hmm. right? And so mm-hmm. I'm lost. I might be, but I'm trying to, at least if I think of it in like a kind of as the container, like, I'm going to still stay there and like be witnessed, like witness, bear witness to whatever might be coming up. I was also thinking about, when you said this, something else too. This actually was something my supervisor said to me quite recently, within the last few weeks, actually. And she was quoting Fred Pine. And I think it was whether it was this patient or another patient, she said, you know, you have to really try to regress yourself in service of the patient's ego. You almost have to be in a space, or I have to almost be in a space where I have to try to allow myself to lose my own sense of my mind, my certainty, which does speak to a point you made earlier, is that when the patient is convincing me or an analyst that they're hurting, they're being hurt by you, it's almost like the patient is unconsciously trying to destroy a part of the analyst's mind. And that's really hard. So when I say, you know, surviving or staying alive, that's a really hard thing to do, you know?
I would say, yes, totally agree. But what makes it even more difficult is that, of course, there are times we actually hurt people. Our wording isn't just right. Our timing isn't just right. Our tone isn't just right. And there are contained in those things hurtfulness, which patients who need to experience that will make that a calamity. And so you have to sit with and parse out, yes, there are realities to our hurtfulness, but then you have to examine, is that really what this is about? Is the fact that you did or didn't smile the way they wanted you to, is that really the hurtfulness and the upsetness that's happening in them? And, you know, that's the nature of the work. You struggle with it and you never get it exactly right. The goal is to develop a partner who can trust you enough to struggle about it with you, which is no small task, as you well know. Mm-hmm. You've had thoughts about being a student in classes with your instructors, and you've told me that you have found them very helpful. And why don't we, since you are sharing your candidate journey, and that is a piece of your candidate journey, why don't you share with us what it's like being a candidate in the many, many hours of classes you take?
So I just finished all my classes, in December, which is great, but I miss it.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It was very enlightening in like the best ways, but also kind of, you know, ways that you don't expect unless you're in it. There's an intensity that even, you know, so with CFS, it's once a week on Monday nights, and it's, you know, 4 hours of classes, and you know, you're learning, you know, depending on its theory, or sharing your work, you know, process notes, cases with your colleagues, your peers, and getting different feedback from different instructors. I think that plus the peer colleague connection that was the most beneficial. You know, again, so over the course of 24 classes, there's 24, you know, different instructors. So you have instructors with a lot of different ideologies, come from different theoretical orientations, have different perspectives, you know, are really, you know, some were really interested in the work I was doing and some not so much, you know, depending on their own set of values and ideas, being sideways themselves. And that, you know, was interesting and also, I think, humbling to kind of see that too, because this is a field of work that historically, with patients who are more complex, you know, some people really don't necessarily want to work with those types of patients or dismiss them quite quickly. And that's hard at times, I think, as a candidate.
You're contrasting them with neurotically structured individuals, yes?
Yes. And I think that too probably has like, that probably too could be like a whole nother like kind of debate of like, because I think there is a new, like right there on the border of like neurotic, you know, there's like, and potentially have, you know, psychotic elements to them. But I think we're also like, the way I like to think about it are these are patients who had very early trauma and like misattunement and attachment issues that probably are not even like actual like memories, but they are felt in their body and they are held in their body, you know, and that they are, we feel them through the patients, through their actions. And so again, back to the idea of slowing down and doing less, these are very reactive patients. They tend to also be patients who have high tendencies for punishing themselves, punishing others, suicidal ideations, ideality. And so they are like more tricky to work with in a sense. I think what I've learned through my supervision, through instructors who are, you know, more open-minded towards pretty much any patient, but also that we're going to see more patients like this in our practices. It's not going to just be one or two because of the way society is kind of getting kind of more enveloped in itself with social media and with being really closed off and lonely, that patients are going to kind of escape into their minds more. And we might see more of these patients. And that's actually something one of my instructor said in a class. It was actually on borderline patients, but she renamed it like the non-symbolizing patient. And I thought that was interesting and, you know, described it as like a disorder of sense of self or dis-ease of sense of self. And I think that has more humanity and more of a humanistic type of way of thinking about someone who really has a dis-ease in their own ability to know themselves. And that's very different than classifying them as, right, like difficult to work with or, sure, you know, untreatable.
That's a nice point. Yeah. It really expresses curiosity, a point you made earlier, about their inner experience as opposed to a label from the outside, which makes all the difference. Definitely. You know, Pam, I think if we were to look at a transcript of our conversation today, one of the phrases that would have jumped out in frequency was, I'm interested in, I'm curious about, I'm learning about. Mm-hmm. And I began by commenting about candidates for the future of our field, that you are so transparent with your curiosity and your interest in learning and your interest in understanding. Sort of answers the implied question about how is the future of our field? And honestly, Pam, I think with you as a future analyst, we can feel good about how our field is going because you are interested in learning and you are interested in not only your patient's inner life, but your inner life as it resonates and can inform something about the patient's inner life. So I want to, on that note, thank you. Thank you for your thoughtfulness. Thank you for your willingness to speak with me and for sharing what it's like to be a candidate in 2026.
Thank you. That was very kind.
Well, I meant it. It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.